All right, we're ready. Good morning. Welcome to Berean Bible Church. Welcome to all the world out there watching. This morning, I want to take a quick look. I want to take a look this morning at the... All done. Let's go. Not so quick. Take a look at the well-known parable commonly referred to as the prodigal son, found in Luke 11 through 32, which was previously read. Most Bible scholars will tell you when looking at the parables that we should never try to press them or take too hard of a look at making the details force into different things that shouldn't be done. And all of that is true. But this morning, while this is a fairly simple story as far as the amount of details we have, there's a lot that can be missed simply because we have a different cultural background than the original hearers did. Lately, we've been learning lots more and more about the cultural surroundings of the first century writings, especially the Hebrew mindset behind them. And this same Hebrew understanding needs to be applied to these parables. And so that's what we're going to be doing this morning. There would be points, details, and concepts that they would have immediately grasped, the story gaps that they would have filled in simply because of their background and understanding. So this morning I want to take a look at this one and dig in a little bit more than usual, and examine it in light of some of the cultural surroundings and understandings that may escape us, to hopefully fill in some of the pieces that we may miss. Now, many people think this is a nice story about forgiveness, and they leave it at that. And while this is a small way, it is in a small way somewhat true, there is much more that never even gets considered. I think the most common application of this parable in the modern church is to see it as applicable to any repentant sinner that comes to God and the forgiveness that he brings. In the latter part of this message, I will explain why I believe this is a false understanding as to the intent and purpose of the original parable story. For most people, I believe, they think of this story and they see it as mainly a story dealing with the one rebellious son. However, there are actually two stories that need focused on, and honestly, the second one is probably more the focal point of the story, considering the audience that he's speaking to. I will mention, though, that this parable is the last part of a series of three parables that Yeshua told in the row in this section. Some commentators have even shown how all three are interconnected to maintain a single thread throughout, but I'm not going to be able to take that route today. Instead, I wish to focus on just this third part. But first, I would like to read the opening remarks that start this entire three-part segment. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. So we see the setting that started out this little trilogy of parables that he speaks. It is because Yeshua has been hanging out with tax collectors and sinners that the Pharisees were grumbling. And due to their grumbling, he spoke to them the three parables. Now, we're going to jump right into the third one about the father and his two sons. As Gary read earlier, hopefully you all remember all that because I'm not going to say it again. Actually, I'm going to be breaking this down into small sections as we go. So, beginning with, and he said, "There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them." What we find here is a request from the younger son to his father, requesting his portion of the inheritance, basically. However, there are a few things that we may miss by not understanding the cultural significance of this request. First off, he is not actually asking for his inheritance. Especially in that type of culture, an inheritance is what one receives when the father passes away. And it means that the son has then become responsible to handle the father's duties. The son would become the leader and assumes the care and the power over what was left unto him. Now, we do see this some in today's modern. I mean, if your father, you know, was a big businessman and owned a big business, he would pass the business to you, and you know, you could either do good or bad with it. But for the most part, when we think of inheritance, we think of, you know, the life insurance that we're going to get when somebody passes. In this case, because they were very agricultural and the father had a big situation here, then it would have meant taking over the duties. For most of us, like I said, most of us, it's just money or the things that we might possess. But In this case, he had servants and employees, and all of that would have been turned over to the son. Now, the son, of course, could turn around, as some do even today, and close shop and cash it all in. But that really rarely happened in that culture. To that culture, the land, the business, and the family were all tied to the place that they were established. And the sons took over to continue enlarging upon what was previously established. The Greek word for inheritance is kleronomia, and it is used elsewhere, like the parable of the vineyard in Matthew 21, where the owner put tenants in the vineyard, and when it came time to reap it, he sent servants, and the tenants killed them. So he sent his son to the tenants. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance." They knew that one day the son would be the boss when he inherited the family business. But in our story, that's not the word that is being used. In our story, the son is not asking for a piece of the family business. He did not want to assume the responsibility or the authority. He simply wanted to cash out and leave on his own. In the normal course of events, when the father died, the two sons would own it all and continue expanding upon it. But in this case, he had no desire to continue with the family at all. In our verse, he uses the word ousia, meaning the son is asking for possessions or wealth that is his portion. In doing this, he is asking to cash out of the whole family. He wants to take what is his and leave, leaving his position in the family and all future connections and benefits of it. He basically wants to break all ties and all relations and go on his own. On top of that, he is asking for something that is not even a consideration that is due to him until his father passes away. Culturally, to ask such a thing as this is equivalent to wishing his father were dead. The Bible background commentary states it this way: to ask one's father for one's share of the inheritance early was unheard of in antiquity. In effect, one would thereby say, "Father, I wish you were already dead." Such a statement would not go over well even today. And in a society stressing obedience to one's father, it would be a serious act of rebellion for which the father could have beaten him or worse. In real life, this request would be met with a refusal, anger, and punishment. And of course, we find that to be the very case throughout Scripture. When Yahweh's people turned their backs on him, it was met with judgment time and time again. However, in this story, the father agrees to let the deal be done, and he divides the possession and gives him his portion. One thing to also note that according to the laws of Deuteronomy, the firstborn would receive a double portion. And so therefore, in this case, the younger son's portion would have only been a third. So after the father has divided things, he gives the son his portion. And then we are told, not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into a far country. Here we find that little time has passed, and the father has given his son his cut. And the son is packed and is now leaving. Now, according to some scholars, the original language that is translated here as "gathered all" literally means he turned everything into cash. This makes more sense in our story, as it would be difficult for the son to have packed up all the physical possessions and property that it would have been bestowed upon him. Plus, the verse goes on to say that he spent everything, thus implying that he had some form of money with him. Now, in order for the son to have sold everything, including part of the family land, he would likely have been selling things quickly and at a low price in order to liquidate them as quickly as he wanted to leave. This would take a big toll on the family overall, because now a big chunk of what was family property and was most likely tied to the family income was gone. Not only would the family have suffered financially due to this, but the father's reputation would have been in question too. Living in a community, a close-knit community like they did at that time, the news of something like this would have spread quickly. Everyone would have heard what was going on, especially as the father and son were going around liquidating things. So for the father, he was not only losing out financially, but the destructive relationship would have brought about public humiliation in the town and to the father's name in general. Now the son has taken everything and left for a far country, and we are told, "And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need." Now, after all of that, the son has left and lost everything. Now all of that money is gone. there is a famine, and he has nothing to survive on. You would think at this point, most kids would run back home with their tail tucked between their legs. But something we may miss here is that according to Jewish custom, he was almost unable to go home. There was a ceremony that was known as the kezaza, which literally means the cutting off. If a Jewish boy lost his inheritance among the Gentiles and sought to return home, the community would perform the ceremony by breaking a large pot in front of him and declare, so-and-so is cut off from his people. Once performed, he would be an outcast and no one would have anything to do with him. So going home would not be putting himself in a very favorable position at this point. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls gives this example of a fatherly warning that relates here. And now, my sons, be watchful of your inheritance that has been bequeathed to you, which your fathers gave you. Do not give your inheritance to the Gentiles, lest you be humiliated in their eyes and foolish, and they trample upon you and become your masters. This is what the son has done. He has squandered his inheritance among the Gentiles. So he was now literally a man without a home and had no way to return to his family or to any of the rights he previously held as a member of his community. When it says in the verse that he took a journey, the Greek word used here by Luke literally means that he traveled away from his own people. So he has left his people, cut all ties and rights to them, took everything he owned, and lived recklessly and lost everything. He had nothing left, nowhere to go, and of course could not simply call his parents to come pick him up. He knows going home would mean dealing with the ridicule of the rest of the village, as well as that of his brother, who now has the rights of the rest of the father's possessions. These points are not ones he could bear with at this point. Instead, he chose another route. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. It is a fact that pigs are mentioned here that most commentators say that he was living, spending, and now working among the Gentiles. The word here translated as hired in our text is often translated as joined to and comes from the root word meaning to glue or attach. It is used elsewhere to refer to everything from dust clinging in Luke 10:11 to joining oneself with a prostitute, 1 Corinthians 6:16. Some commentators state it is not uncommon for a man to join himself to another, even if it is not something that the other party desires. Kind of like what some of us may have seen when you go to the big cities and you pull up to a stoplight and the guy runs out and starts washing your windows and you don't tell him to do that and he wants to be paid. It's kind of like he has clinging to you. They say that that's sort of what the son has done here. It's not that he's been hired, but he's went and made himself of service. That could, that being the case, it explains sort of the job he has given. Chances are his speech and dress would have given him away as being a Hebrew, and in an effort to rid himself of this man, the person assigns him a job that he suspects will cause the man to leave. It can be hard for us to fully grasp how this would be for someone from a culture that loathes pigs. But the son accepts even this. He is that desperate. So desperate, in fact, that the next verse tells us, and he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. The Greek word here translated as longing is a very strong word and implies a very strong desire. Some say that the pods spoken of here were not something that could even be digested by humans, and thus he was unable to even eat them, but he truly and strongly desired to be able to. Things were getting worse for him, and there was no relief in sight. He couldn't eat what the pigs were eating, and asking others was not working, as no one gave him anything. He was finally at the end of his rope, unable to provide anything for himself. He was broke and starving, and death was surely in his future. So he decided that there was only one option left. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.'" One thing we should notice here is that the son is not necessarily repentant. Many over the years have understood that when it says he came to himself, it implies a repentant attitude. But others point out that there is nothing in the language that actually reveals this at all. He does not mention being sorry for anything he had done. He simply realizes that he is truly starving and decided that enough is enough. He reasons that even his father's servants have food, and that is what he desires so that he won't perish. He will acknowledge his sin against the father, but only because it is a means to an end. He desires to eat, even if it is as a servant. The words he chooses to say to his father may have some significance here too. Yeshua is talking to an audience that knows the scripture. They are quite a scholarly group. When the son says, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you," the words used here are a paraphrased version of the words of Pharaoh to Moses after the plagues. Pharaoh says, "I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you." Some commentators say that the Aramaic version of this word, of this verse, is worded even more closely to the way it is stated in our text in Luke. If that is indeed a legitimate link, we all know that Pharaoh was not repentant. He simply wanted to manipulate Moses and get away from the bad situation. And that seems to be a similar attitude that the son has in our story here. Because he was in dire straits with no options, he would choose what he believes are the right things to say, hoping his father would have him back as a servant. Of course, he is not asking to be restored to the family. If he were accepted back as a servant, it would mean he would most likely reside in a nearby village with the other workers and not in the family home. He does not ask to be in any way restored to the former relationship as a son, nor does he ask to in any way be a part of any inheritance. He is still not asking for that responsibility or relationship. The son is seeing the root issue to be focused on his losing everything and starving, and not to breaking the relationship or breaking his father's heart. It seems he is not aware of what he has actually done. The issue of relationship with the father does not seem to be the focus at all. He simply wants to return and get food. Reconciliation does not seem to be his goal in taking this course of action. I'm sure most of us can see modern ways this scenario may play out. For instance, say one of our children has done something to completely hurt the parents in some way by breaking their trust or disobeying them directly, and they get caught doing so. The child will most likely apologize, but most likely the focus of their concern will be with the issue that they got caught in. Rarely are they aware of the damaged relationship with the parents. They are simply sorry they got caught, and they say what is needed to satisfy the uncomfortable position they are in. Reconciliation is not usually the thought they have. They simply want to get out of the bad situation of getting caught. Had they not gotten caught, they probably would have done nothing. If the prodigal son had not ended up like he had, chances are he would not have even considered returning home. He was only doing so because he was desperate. And so we are told, and he arose and came to his father. Now, as the son approached the town, he surely would have been thinking more and more of what he would say, maybe even practicing how he would lay it on thick to gain sympathy. He probably pondered how he would handle facing the townspeople, who, once they had discovered what he did, would perform the kazaza ceremony against him. This would mean having to take their punishment before he could even make it to see his father at all. And who knows how long it would be before he would eventually be summoned to the presence of his father. By that point, the village would have rejected him, and surely then his father would be very angry, and he would have to plead to be taken back as a servant. After all, not only did he, in essence, declare a death wish upon his father, but he then left and lost everything among the pagan nations. However, we know what happens, and it is not at all what you would expect in this situation. The text tells us, "But while he was a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him." Now, this action of the father's is very much against what a man in his position would normally do. He's basically breaking all the rules of the Orient patriarchy just by running. The Greek word here used for ran is the technical term used for the foot races in the stadium. So we are actually told the father raced to the son with urgency. In their culture, a man of his age would always walk slowly and in a dignified manner. They would never, ever run. To do so would require him to reach down and take the front ends of his robe and hike them up so that he could run, and doing that would expose his legs, which was considered a humiliating posture for him. Performing this action would be to bring great shame upon himself, on top of the shame the son's prior actions has already brought upon him and the family name. But obviously the father was not concerned at all about this. His compassion leads him to do these acts, and knowing how the villagers would treat the son upon his arrival, he probably ran even faster to catch up to him. This is the father leaving his high home, assuming a humiliating posture in order to seek he who was lost and bring about reconciliation. As parents, we could all learn from this scenario. When our children go astray, how quick are we to run and say, "I told you so," or berate them with scornful speech? Often the parents will belittle them and ask them and bring them to shame. But here we find pretty much the opposite of that. We find the father humiliating himself to reconcile with his rebellious son. And the father has done all of this without hearing word one from the son. Is the son repentant? The father doesn't know. Is he coming home to repay all that he took? The father doesn't know. Whatever the news is, the father has yet to hear it, yet he humiliates himself to run and love his lost son. There are those in the Islam faith who actually use this story to show that man can be saved without a savior, without Yeshua. They claim the boy repents, returns, and the father forgives him. They say, therefore, there is no need for the cross, no suffering, and no savior needed to get to God. They totally miss the suffering, sacrifice, and humility that is portrayed here. They also fail to see this story as representing the Father in heaven sending his Son, who is God incarnate, who assumes a humiliating position as a human in order to passionately go out and seek and save those who were lost and bring them into reconciliation and sonship once again. They also, like many commentators today, make the mistake of viewing this whole story and the characters involved as basically a representation of God the Father loving and reconciling any repentant sinner unto himself. However, in light of audience relevance and what Yeshua has come to do, I find it hard to agree with that general assessment of the parties involved or the main focus of the story. But I'll discuss that a little later. As the story continues, and the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." Now, in case you didn't notice it here, the son had planned his planned confession here. It was a bit longer than it is here. What happened to the last sentence when he was to say, "Treat me as one of your hired servants," as he was mentioning back in verse 19? Was he caught off guard by the actions of his father and maybe just forgot? Had he along the road decided against that portion? Can you imagine what must have been going through his mind just moments before? He is walking home, knowing he has rejected his family and brought shame to them, knowing he will definitely face being outcast by the rest of the village and probably greatly punished. Now, he reaches the village, and here he sees his father running towards him. Not knowing what the father would do, he may have thought that his father was running to take swift vengeance against him. After the way he had rejected him, he knew he deserved such a response. So surely he would have been shocked and taken back when the father instead came and threw his arms around him and started kissing him. Maybe that threw him for a loop and caused him to forget his planned speech. Or maybe instead, the son now realized he had no right to ask anything of the father directly. Instead, he would just throw himself on the mercy of the father and accept whatever happens at his hand. Or it is possible that the son was cut off in his speech as the father interrupts him. But the father said to his servants, "Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. The twist here is that in this situation, it should be the son who comes bearing gifts. The son is in the wrong. He has committed great wrongdoings against his father, and it is he who owes a major debt. But he comes empty-handed with nothing to offer the father. He basically has spat in his father's face and wished him dead, cutting all ties as a son, and now returns declaring he is unworthy to be called a son still. Instead, he is given a king's return and restored fully to sonship. Now, being lavish with gifts so quickly and so publicly, it would surely stop any idea of the villagers performing the kizaza ceremony, as the son was now openly reconciled to his father. Unfortunately, I cannot spend any time here going into the details about the gifts and significance of them, but let's just suffice it to say that they were prime, extravagant gifts from the father. Now, while all of this is going on, the older son returns home. Now, his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to them, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf, because he has received him back safe and sound." But he was angry and refused to go in. Now, in their culture, the eldest son is the one responsible for assisting in the reconciliation process between the father and any of the younger brothers that may, any of these reconciliation processes that may arise. The older brother should have stepped in way back at the beginning of the story and tried wholeheartedly to stop the younger brother from doing what he was doing in breaking his father's heart to begin with. But he did not. The older brother was obviously not doing his duty. He was not being respectful to the father or loving to the brother. Now that the brother has returned, he is more upset and refuses to even join the party. In doing so, he is showing his hatred of his brother as well as disrespecting the father himself, and he deserves punishment now himself. Also, in their custom, in these types of parties, the oldest son is usually serving in the place of kind of like a head waiter. He is not a waiter in the sense as the servants that wait on the guests, but he is in charge and is a visible sign of just how respected the guests are. He would be like a manager overseeing things and interacting and introducing them as the guests come in. So his refusal to do so in this situation is further disrespect to his father's guests. For the older son, this whole situation is inconceivable. Reconciliation and restoration cannot occur without a penalty being paid by the offending party. That is the way it has to be. And since that is not what has happened, the older son is too angry to take any part in this. The older son's rebellious attitude is public, and the guests, as well as the father, are made aware of his attitude in this situation, because the father immediately responds, but instead of punishment as the son deserves, the verse tells us, his father came out and entreated him. Again, the father responds in an out-of-the-ordinary fashion. The son's public refusal of duty as well as disrespect for brother and father should be met with sternness, but instead the father pleads with the son to not act this way. The word used here for entreat means to call to one's side, strive to appease, to exhort, to comfort, to encourage. It is the same word Paul uses in 2 Corinthians 5:20. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. The father is begging the older son to change his mind and be reconciled with his brother, as the father has already done. But the oldest instead lays forth his case in frustration. But he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your commands, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." Through this statement, the oldest son exposes a few things. First, he does not even properly show respect to his father in his speech. The normal cultural response from the son should have been something like, "Oh, father, these many years." But instead, the son blurts out, "Look at what I have done." Second, extreme jealousy is obvious as he states how the father has done so much for the rebellious son and yet has done nothing for him in all of these years of obedience. On top of revealing the jealousy, he is also accusing his father of favoritism here. His anger for his brother becomes clearly evident when instead of referring to him as his brother, he refers to him as the son of yours. They both have the same father, and yet he will not associate with him in a family setting. Again, the outburst of disrespect from the older son should get him immediately arrested and taken away for punishment by the word of the father. That is what normally would happen in that culture. But again, the father does the opposite. And he said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. The father does not respond in anger, nor in any form of punishment or rebuke is mentioned here. He overlooks the disrespect, the bitterness, the arrogance, and the accusation of favoritism. Instead, the father reminds the oldest son that what is left of the inheritance all belongs to him. All that he has worked obediently for still is in his possession. The father also addresses his son here using a different form of the word son. All through this story, the normal word for son has been used, but here, when addressing the older son, he uses the term technon, which is the word displaying great love and affection. The only rebuke is that the oldest son should likewise be celebrating at the return of his lost brother. He should be showing appreciation that the lost son has returned and been restored to the fellowship with the family. How does the oldest son respond in this final statement from the father? The story stops, and we stand waiting alongside the other party guests, wondering just what will the rebellious son's attitude be. Will he give up his rebellion and likewise be reconciled with the father and return to the house in humility? We do not know from the story itself because it is addressed to the audience of Yeshua's day, and their response was being revealed at that time. He was addressing a rebellious group of religious leaders who stand in opposition to this message. As with most of his parables, this one is directed to them. Will they be reconciled with the Father, or will their hardness of heart not allow it? Well, of course, we know the ending of the story as it played out in history. I would like to use the words of a writer, Kenneth Bailey, here, who says, "Then the oldest son, in great anger, took his stick and struck the father." This, of course, is referencing the response of the religious leaders of the day who stayed in their rebellion, continued to reject the message as well as the messenger from the father, and took that messenger and nailed him to the cross. They were not favorable nor tolerant of the other brother being brought back into the family with them. And we see that struggle throughout the New Testament. Of course, we also know that the Father did not respond in love to them in the end, as he brought fire and destruction down upon them and their city, wiping them out of the family permanently. Now, at this point, I wish to leave this story itself and look at the scenario from a different angle than most of the commentators I have read. As I mentioned earlier, most see this story as an example of how God welcomes and loves any repentant sinner that comes to him. The problem I have with this assessment is that it does not fit the relevance of what is being said, to whom it is being said to, and it doesn't fit the players in the story. As I said before, the chapter contains three parables, this being the third in the trilogy of stories. As read earlier, the chapter starts by saying, "And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them." So we know some of the main people being addressed here by Yeshua are the Pharisees, as usual, with his parables. One thing that people seem to gloss over in this story is that it is a story of two sons and a father. The father and two children already related to him. They are children of God, part of his family in the beginning, and one of the children forsakes the family and leaves. The Pharisees represent the older brother in this story. In life, the Pharisees represent the two tribes that are still serving and maintaining a covenant relationship with Yahweh in that day. That alone should assist in revealing that the younger son is not representative of just sinners returning to God in general. The one returning is one that beforehand was close in covenant with God, not a stranger to God and the covenant as everyday people coming to God would be. If that were the case and this were just representing ordinary people, then this is telling us that they were in close covenant with the Father, left the covenant, and then came back. That would be to say that they were alive in the Father, chose to leave, thus being dead to the Father, and then returning to the Father. Some, of course, do view this story as focused on people who have made a decision for Christ, but have been strayed from that, and then later return. But even this is hard to apply to just ordinary people in the world when we seriously consider all of the things surrounding this story. A better understanding is that the younger son represents those 10 tribes that were removed from the covenant in the past due to their sin and disobedience. These 10 northern tribes were, One, in covenant relationship with the Father, just as a younger son was. Two, they were cut off from the Father, just as a younger son was. Three, they were considered dead to the Father, just as a younger son was. Four, they were intermingled with the pagan nations, just as a younger son was. They were being restored to the Father through the Messiah, just as a younger son was. And they were causing the two tribes to recoil and rebel against the Messiah for allowing them to return. God has previously promised that this would happen, and it was happening in their day. For some reason, the current religious regime was not seeing that as the plan and were not accepting it. And that is why the story has an open ending, because they were being told what was happening and were to decide their response. Let's take a brief look at some of what is said on this topic with a little background history first. There were the 12 tribes, and they were previously split into two separate nations. The two tribes of Judah and Benjamin were considered the southern kingdom, and together they were referred to as Judah. The other 10 tribes made up the northern kingdom, and they were designated by the name Israel. Now, when we get to the book of Hosea, we see that Hosea is told by the Lord to take a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom. These children are named names that represent the tribes in various ways. The first son was named Jezreel. Call his name Jezreel, for in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. Remember, that was the 10 tribes. So we are told here the 10 tribes, referred to as the house of Israel, will be brought to their end. Jezreel means that God has sown, and in the sowing or scattering, as in the sowing or scattering of seeds. Then we are told the next child was a daughter named No Mercy. Call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all, but I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God. And then another son came. When she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, call his name not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. So here we are told these children will be the end of the kingdom of the house of Israel. They will be scattered and sown, and they will be called No Mercy and not my people. But then in verse 11, the promise to them is made, and the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. This one head will, of course, be the Messiah. So the promise is that they are no longer a nation and are scattered away from the covenant, but that one day they will be brought back and reconciled unto God through the Messiah. This idea appears in places throughout the First Testament scriptures, but is pretty clearly again stated in one place that I would like to bring into the mix. So I've been brought in, if you're here this morning for the devotion for the Lord's Supper, we were in Ezekiel. Well, we're going to go back to Ezekiel 37. This is why I knew that answer when he asked this morning. Ezekiel 37, Valley of Dry Bones. We have the story of the Valley of Dry Bones. Most people know this story. The prophet is taken to a valley, shown old dry bones. They are given flesh and brought back to life with the Spirit of God. This is understood as resurrection imagery, looking to the day when the people are restored to life in the land of promise. This story is followed by a second story, the two sticks story. Son of man, take a stick and write on it for Judah and the people of Israel associated with him. Then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel associated with him, and join them one to another into one stick, that they may become one in your hand. And when the people say to you, will you tell us what you mean by these? So we have two sticks, each representing the kingdoms of the groups of the northern and southern kingdoms, as we've already discussed. He says that they will one day be brought back into one stick. And when inquired as to what this means, we are told, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will take the people of Israel from the nations among which they have gone, and will gather them from all around, and bring them to their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. And one king shall be king over them all, and they shall no longer be two nations, and no longer divided into two kingdoms. And they shall not defile themselves any more with their idols and their detestable things, or with any of their transgressions. But I will save them from all the backslidings in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God. My servant David shall be king over them, and they will, And they shall all have one shepherd. They shall walk in my rules and be careful to obey my statutes. I wish I could go further on in the later verses of God's new covenant and how it will be made and how he will set his sanctuary in the midst of them to dwell with them forever, but that would be a whole nother study. What we have here is a promise of the restoring of the people of Israel who had been scattered among the nations and to bring them back and merge these two groups so that they were no longer two kingdoms but one, and that one kingdom shall be ruled by David, which we understand to be Yeshua, the Messiah, the descendant of David. They shall be ruled by him, and they shall have one shepherd. Hopefully, the idea of shepherd here is something we have come across frequently in the ministry of the Messiah, who called himself the shepherd, tying it right back into Ezekiel. He stated, "I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, not two, one flock, one shepherd." Again, we see the Messiah as shepherd, going forth to find the sheep, not of the current fold, to bring them and make one flock under one shepherd, instead of the two current flocks that had existed before. Another time, the Messiah plainly states, he is there for one specific and main focus in his earthly ministry. In response to the pleas of the Canaanite woman, Yeshua stated, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Here is the mention of those lost, scattered people of the house of Israel. This is who the Messiah was first interested in retrieving. Earlier in Matthew, when Yeshua was sending out his apostles to preach, he plainly told them, "These 12 Jesus sent out, instructing them, 'Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.'" Their mission for that time was not to be unto anyone except those lost sheep of the house of Israel, as promised in Hosea. So the main focus of Christ's earthly work was to retrieve the lost sheep of Israel. Then we come to our text of the parable in Luke 15. And as I said, there's actually three parables here. And lo and behold, the first parable is about a lost sheep being found and a great celebration that occurs over that. Same symbolism, Christ came to find those lost sheep of the house of Israel. So then we jump onto our parable later on, and the theme is still there. The two sons represent the two houses, Israel and Judah. Israel, the youngest brother, starts in covenant, but is broken off, dispersed among the pagan nations. And then later, as a lost sheep, some are brought back in love and mercy with the Father. In continuing to look at this in the first century, we can jump over to 1 Peter, who we see he is writing to these same dispersed people, the house of Israel. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And what does he say to these dispersed people of the house of Israel? He goes through the rest of that chapter 1, showing them the plan of God for salvation. And then we get to chapter 2. "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." Remember in Hosea, the house of Israel were called no mercy and not a people. So Peter is directly addressing the promise of Hosea here. He states later in that same chapter to these same people, "For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls." Again, the straying, dispersed people being brought back into one nation under the shepherd Messiah as promised. Then we look back to Hosea briefly to pick up verse 10 of that first chapter. "Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured in number. And in the place where it is said to them, 'You are not my people,' it shall be said to them, 'Children of the living God.'" As we read through the ministry of Yeshua, knowing his main task is to the lost house of Israel, and we understand that in Hosea they will be restored and called children of the living God, we should start picking up on that language coming about through his work. We find, for instance, at the announcement of the birth of John the Baptist, who, remember, was there to prepare the way for the work of the Messiah. The angel states about John, and he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. So we have the people of Israel referred to as children from the start. Then, looking back to the same story already touched upon when he was dealing with the Canaanite woman and stating that he was only there for the lost house of Israel, she presses him further, and he states, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Here is a connection to the lost house of Israel with the term children again. But actually, the language of this same story in Mark adds a tidbit more and shows the fuller ministry of the Messiah, at least I think so. "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." He is not totally denying the Gentile woman permanently. He is saying that his first mission is to the children of Israel. This implies what we know begins to take place later on, when that mission stops being about the lost sheep of the house of Israel and turns to being open to all the pagan Gentile nations under Paul. Now we jump over to Yeshua as he stands before Caiaphas the high priest, and it is said of him, he, Caiaphas, did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So again, here we have those scattered abroad being referred to as the children of God being brought into one, just as Hosea and Ezekiel had promised. The Messiah had come to first save those lost sheep, gathering from among the scattered tribes those that would be brought back as the children of God into one kingdom under the shepherd. And of course, to make sure that we do not misunderstand this as to say that he was only there and that only the houses of Israel and Judah were being called children of God, as some promote these days, we know from the opening remarks in John that after Yeshua came to his own and was rejected in the end, that his grace was granted to others. He came to his own and his people did not receive him, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. These non-bloodline-born people who believed in Messiah were brought in and given the right to become the children of God. They were not in any way born with that right as the tribes were, but they were born from and through the grace and power of Yahweh and granted the right to be brought into the same fold with the children of God. That would be us, in case I'm not making that clear enough. Anyway. So to bring this all to a close, hopefully you can see now how the story of the prodigal son is not a story about any and all repentant sinners who come to God. It is, in fact, the story of two nations and the Father. It is a piece of the final chapter of a long story and promise made long beforehand. Both nations, represented by two sons, start under the Father's care in covenant with him. One nation is separated, scattered among the pagans, losing all of their covenant rights and considered dead and in the world of darkness. The plan is to bring those scattered people back together under the Father once again. This is only done when the Father takes action, sending himself in to do the job, taking on the humiliation, becoming a man, the Messiah, and going forth to seek and save those who were lost. The other nation was never being separated or scattered like that, yet they had hostility towards the plans of the Father, and therefore they despised the plans of the Son, and they rejected him as their Messiah. Like the older son, they were greatly angered by the Father that he would be doing that what he was doing and allowing the sinful nation to come back and be restored on equal footing to them. They refused fellowship with the nations being received back in, treating them as outcasts. And they rebelled against the plan of Yahweh, which in the end cost them their right to be children. And they were cast out and utterly destroyed with their house and their entire system of worship. While the story of the prodigal son does show the extent of love and mercy that the Father has and bestows, even to us today who were former aliens to the covenant, the story must first be understood as a story relating to the promises of Hosea and Ezekiel and other Old Testament scriptures, and that being the bringing together of the two kingdoms back into one under the one shepherd. In accomplishing this, Yeshua then becomes the all in all, fulfilling all that the tribes never could, and thus receiving in himself the promises that were given beforehand to the covenant people. He has inherited all that the Father has promised, becoming the light of the world and bringing reconciliation to any from the nations of the world who would turn to him. Let us pray. Father God, we are so thankful for your word. We're so thankful for your plan. We're thankful for the love and mercy that you do show towards us when we were yet sinners. We're thankful for the messages that we are given through your word, that we may rely on them and have faith in them. Father, help us today as we ponder on your word, that we would look for the ways in which you have given us these examples, that we may see what you are saying and understand and take application of that to ourselves, but always to first understand what is being said in these stories and to the audience that is being spoken to. We're thankful for the many blessings we have, and we pray that you would bless this day.